Welcome to Wellness Radio with Dr. Jeanette Gallagher as your host. Her show discusses topics of health, wellness, and spirituality and is about discovering your place in this great universe from your cells to the cosmos. Along with her guest, in casual conversation, she strives to ask the difficult questions that may be holding you back from a vibrant life and shares new ideas that may inspire you to make a change in your life that you only can see in your dreams. And now, here is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Wellness Radio. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher. It's a pleasure to have you with us here this evening. Tonight, we are going to be talking about what is the recipe for a good life, the recipe for a great business. How about the recipe for being present on this earth these days? Because I don't know about you, but my challenge list has grown so long, I've been tripping on it. You know, we have so many of these different things in the world today that, you know, life is not as simple as it was laid out to us in the 50s and the 60s when I grew up. It's a dog-eat-dog world, get out there and just climb that ladder, or here's what you're going to do, get all these letters behind your name because you'll have a long obituary and you'll have a great tombstone. Well, life has totally changed from that, you know, these days. I mean, everybody is saying, you know, I'm not into that anymore. I'm going to throw away my big house. I'm going to throw away my 10 cars. Are we? Are we also going to say, maybe I'm going to just go and help people? Maybe I'm going to be more compassionate. Maybe I'm going to figure out what the heck is in this body? What is it all about? Today, my guest is John David Mann. His books that we will be sharing today, one is The Recipe, A Story of Loss, Love, and the Ingredients of Greatness, and the other is The Go-Giver, A Little Story About a Powerful Business Idea. While these might seem so separate, they are totally in sync, and they are about how we can set up ourselves to know who we are, our place in the world, and what we really want to share or join forces with in the world. Because it really is all about everybody coming together. This is not a silo experience, as I always say. We're not in a silo. We can't exist and go on and everything's good for us and, hey, you know, let the rest of the world go on its own way. So thank you, John, so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you.
John, time that we just, you know, recognize that life that we may have been pumped into us is no longer, right?
we are definitely learning the ropes as we go.
Yeah, and it changes, don't you think? I mean, our lives right now are totally different from our parents or our grandparents, yes?
Well, yeah, they are. And I think, you know, I suspect that it's always been that way, that you know, change, of course, is the one constant. And it's always been an upsetting, confusing, topsy-turvy world. I think that there was historically that little period where we sort of had the illusion of stability. You mentioned the 50s and the 60s, and I think it kind of shattered in the 60s, but it shattered a whole lot more. And then the digital revolution came along, and terrorism came along. So any illusions we had that the Leave It to Beaver world was reality, I think, are long behind us. And I don't think it's a bad thing. I just think it's a thing.
Yeah, I think it's just a transition, you know. If we look at different things in life, they're really a transition. You know, after the wars, you know, we had to come to the place that everybody wanted to have stability. You know, then after they got stability, they wanted to put up their fortress. Then it was all about them, you know, in the 90s, and now we realize it's all about us, you know, or the we combination now, don't you think?
I do, and I mean, there are certainly a lot of terrible things in the world, but I have observed a really powerfully positive trend since I marked it at 9/11. I'm sure that wasn't the sole marking point, but that's kind of where I perceive it. I think there was a real soul searching and a real reexamination of our values after 9/11. Perhaps it was the turn of the millennium, and perhaps it was many things. Maybe 9/11 was just the most obvious dramatic event that marked that point. But people started to, to start asking themselves hard questions and deep questions, and why am I here? And there we started to see much more value given, for example, to social consciousness in business and in the social value of business. What is a business's impact on the environment, impact on its workers, impact on its customers, impact? And that's, people started to vote with dollars about not just the products they were buying, but how the company were behaving. I mean, that's only one example of many. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think people complain, people our age complain about the millennials and about the new generation Xers and how they don't have no attention span and how they're just so selfish. And that is not my observation. My observation is these kids have remarkable global consciousness and inclusivity and a mindset that really embraces the new millennium. So I think there's a lot to be very positive about.
Yeah, I think the new millennials, as they call them, I think they are more expansive in their consciousness and their thoughts. Mm-hmm. In other words, there is no, quote, solution to a problem. There's potentials that are out there. And I've said this so many times, you know, people, I've been in healthcare since the early 70s, and they're like, well, here's my problem, and I need you to fix it. And it's like, well, good luck with that, you know? And because it's really about the potentials are out there and how you can progress through life and what your process is and your experience versus trying to get to that place. You know, everybody claims, well, I need health care. Well, what the heck is health care? No, you need medical care so that you'll be able to figure out where you are, you know?
Yeah. It has, and, you know, our whole approach to health has begun to change so dramatically in the 70s. Really, in the 70s was still a time when we as a society went to the doctor and said, I'm sick, fix it. And that was it. It was like taking your car to the auto mechanic. You don't try to fix your car. You take it to the doctor. And we, I think that our experience with cancer, perhaps, and perhaps it was the McGovern report and dietary needs, and perhaps it was new findings about heart disease and lifestyle, whatever it was, we as a culture began to take more responsibility for our own health. And I think that's been an enormously positive step, both for the population and for the medical world.
I think it's also, too, the idea of giving up power. Because people gave up their power. When antibiotics came along, they were, quote, the powerhouse. So, and you could only get it from the power guy down the street. And he was powerful because he went to college and you were not as, in whatever, affluent or intelligent or whatever you want to call it, and we'll just throw those words out there, to be able to be that power person. So you had to go to that power person. In other words, you didn't have the capacity to make your own decisions, so they took away your power. And I think now, even with your books, you know, The Go-Giver, it's about bringing your power back in, even with the recipe. Bring your power back in and know what you know what you feel, and start to learn from yourself versus being always going out and saying, someone else take care of me. You know, I mean, just as I said in the beginning with that silo existence, you know, you think of a silo like a corn silo, you know, I'm all within this glass wall. Well, really, it's all about being able to participate in all these things in life, just like the millennials, to be able to figure things out for yourself versus, you know, having all the answers, the fix it, the, you know, the solution. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. Yes, and, you know, we talked about 9/11. Of course, another big benchmark, as we do our little historical look and review, another big benchmark, of course, was the economic crash of 2008 and 2009. Now, that's personal for me. I mean, it's personal for everyone. But speaking of the Go-Giver came out just about 10 years ago. It was published the very last few days of 2007. So it existed in the world for 8 or 9 months before Lehman Brothers went bankrupt and the stock market crashed and the whole world sort of started to blow up economically. And this is interesting because, you know, here's a book. The premise for our listeners who don't know the book, the premise of The Go-Giver is this. It's a parable. It's a simple little story that teaches, that's meant to teach some basic principles. And the story, the core principle in the story is that taking your focus off yourself and putting it on others is not only a morally satisfying and sort of ethically nice, noble way to live, it's also pragmatic. It's also effective. That is, we call this a little story about a powerful business idea. It's not really just a business idea. It's a life idea. It goes back to the Gospels. It goes back to, you know, with the wisdom of the ages. But we put it all over as a business idea, and we mean that, because when you put your focus on other people, you put other people first, that turns out to make you more valuable in the marketplace. It makes your reputation better. It makes you, it actually improves your worth in the dollars and cents business world. You become a more valuable person. So our whole point was, it isn't a question of, are you going to be nice? Or are you going to be successful? Are you going to put your focus on other people and be like an altruistic sop? Or are you going to put your me first, dog eat dog, get to the top? It's a false dilemma. It's a false choice. It's a treacherous dichotomy. The truth is, it's not an either or choice. Putting your focus on other people doesn't mean you sacrifice your own success. In fact, it contributes to your success. So, here comes this book with this nice idea. And then the economy crashed. And, you know, part of me was figuring, oh, boy, people are going to be really trenching, right, retrenching. They're losing their jobs, losing their houses, losing their 401ks. Things are going bad, belly up, underwater. And no one's going to have time for this, you know, feel-good, nice little story. The book started selling better. In fact, it's selling more copies per month today in 2017 than it was when it came out in 2008. It's just gotten more and more traction over time. And I think that it's really signaled a shift in mindset in the business world. And I think that's, you know, that's all to the great, all to the hurrah.
But also, too, I think that people have started to realize as these world events occur is that how they're doing business in their own life, in their own jobs, in their own families, they're just being, they're more disheartened. It doesn't feel good to them. They're starting to notice things that just don't resonate with them anymore. And they're saying, that just turns my stomach. That's not something good. Or the concept, you know, that you work at a job and because it's your paycheck, but you know that what you're doing at the job is just not right. So really, the idea of the Go-Giver book and the recipe book is really about being able to start to rebuild yourself from the inside out to be able to present yourself with these qualities. Because once you do that, then you're able to say, you know, I no longer can tolerate working at that place. Or you can go the other road and you could say, I can help them change the work at that place. Or you could look at it, you know, in other words, you can get all of these other potentials that are out there versus just going down the road, well, I hate this job and this is what I'm going to do. And, you know, kind of idea, yes?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I have kind of a weird relationship with the concept of job, and it's not a bad relationship. I don't, you know, it's not antipathy or loathing. It's just it's kind of a foreign concept to me.
Right.
I've had jobs. I know what one of those is. I've had one or two of those. You know, but it's not something I'm that familiar with most of my life. You know, when I was 17 years old, I dropped out of high school and started my own high school. And I went to it as a senior and I graduated from it. And then a year later, I went back and joined the faculty and taught at it. And it was a successful institution. We sent graduates to places like Harvard and Yale and Princeton, and, you know, and it's it was my first experience, I think, in sort of my first organized experience in entrepreneurism. But, you know, when I talk about that experience, people say, well, how on earth, at the age of 17, you start your own high school? What leads you to even think you could do that?
Right.
Well, my mother led me to think I could do that. My mother, you know, brought me up with the dictum that you can do whatever you set out to do. And I think that's actually a fairly common baby boomer experience. I think that that our generation subscribed to a great degree as previous generations had not to this idea that you can carve your own path, you can be your own man, you can set your own parameters. Which my point in that is, I think that one of the things that the Go-Giver and the recipe have in common is that they really focus on not what does the world expect of you or what does the world want you to be, but what kind of person do you want to be?
Right, you want
what
to
kind
be.
Of values do you want to represent? Mm-hmm. Because if you, it's kind of the if you build it, they will come idea.
Mm-hmm.
If you become the person that you want to be and need to be, then circumstances in the world at large will tend to rearrange themselves to accommodate that. It's kind of like when people have asked me, how do you find the perfect soulmate, perfect life partner? I get asked this a lot because my wife and I had such a wonderful marriage, although it was hard won. We didn't find it till we were both 50. We spent the first half century practicing and not doing well. But my philosophy about that is the way that you attract the right partner, the way you find the right partner is you don't find the right partner. You just be the right person. You be the right partner, and they're going to find you. It's going to the magnetic forces are going to come into play. Mm-hmm. It's really about yourself. It's about developing yourself. It's like I used to do photography, and I'll never forget the experience of dropping that piece of thick paper into that little vat of chemicals and watching the picture mm-hmm. emerge. That's what we're doing with ourselves. We drop ourselves into the vat of our experience, and what's the picture that's going to emerge? Focus on who we want to be, and circumstances will respond to that rather than trying to chase the circumstance, whether it's chasing money or chasing a job or chasing a goal or chasing a career or chasing whatever. Rather than chase, just be and let the success find you, let the circumstances find you.
I think so, too, that if we look back at history, you know, we say about the mothers, that was really a time when the mothers were also saying in their thoughts that they wished that they could do things, and that wasn't quite the time of mothers being able to go out and do, you know, work or professions
for sure.
Or whatever. Right. So then the mothers eventually started to do that, too. But if we really look at it, all of those, you know, the 1900s was really about how we fit into the world outside of us. And now we're all looking at who we are
right.
inside of us.
Right.
And that's just, and if you really look at it as out there in here, you know, eventually I hope we come to a place that it meshes all together. But, you know, we're kind of still on that bumpy journey of, you know,
yeah.
how my outside fits in with my inside. And how do I really find that path along in this life? In the book, In the Recipe, A Story of Lost Love and the Ingredients of Greatness, it's really about, you know, when you talk about your character, you know, it's really about how they are trying to find their way in life and all of the bumps and bruises along the way, what they think it should be, what they thought it would be, you know, when you lose something and things just don't go your way, what do? Do you put your foot down and have a temper tantrum? Do you sit down and have a loss? You know, do you lose the rest of your life? Do you sell your soul? What do you do? And it's really about how to get back up and explore that.
It is. And you know, again, for listeners who don't know the book, so I'm going to give you a quick sketch of what the story is in the recipe. It's about a young boy, 14 years old, who, as the story opens, has recently lost his dad to a young heart attack, an unexpected heart attack. And so the boy's life is circling the drain. He's angry at the world. He's grieving. He's torn up inside. And he does. He lashes out in an act of vandalism, throwing a rock through a window, and that lands him in a job where he crosses paths with this crusty old diner chef who is basically teaching him how to cook in his little cramped diner kitchen. And at that point, it's kind of like it becomes the Karate Kid meets Master Chef. That's
mm-hmm.
kind of the setup of the book. And as you say, it is. It's his exploring kind of how to find his way back to a meaningful life. But to me, there's two things that are really, really salient there. One of them is that the boy is, yes, he's angry. Yes, he's lashing out and so forth and so on. But also, he is alone. That, you know, most of us didn't lose our fathers at the age of 14. I know I didn't. But all of us have lost something. All of us have had some experience with a tragedy, and maybe not the death of someone close to us. It could be that, or it could be, You know, maybe you had a friend who you thought was a friend and then betrayed you in some way. Or maybe you had a friend who moved away because their parents moved and you lost that friendship. Or maybe you had a pet that died. Or maybe you had a business that went belly up. Or maybe you had a relationship that broke up and left you heartsick for a year. Whatever it is, we've all experienced some kind of loss that has really hurt in a deep place. And so, you know, one of the things I've noted, and this book is kind of an exploration of what happens when that happens and where do you go from there? And I think one of the things that happens is that you tend to feel like you're alone. You know, they say when you laugh, the whole world laughs with you, but when you cry alone. And that's where Owen, the boy, is at the beginning of the book. And that's, you know, I've had tragedies in my life, and I remember that when they occurred, I thought that nobody in the world had had that happen but me. Mm-hmm. And nobody could possibly really understand what had happened but me. Of course, that isn't true, but we think it's true. You get isolated. And so one of the things that happens is that he meets this mentor. And I think that, you know, the other day someone asked me, how do you find your way out of that place of loss? And the first thought that came to my mind was, well, you know, the first step may be to open your arms and make yourself vulnerable to other people, because you tend to do the opposite, to clam up and go off in a corner and suck your thumb.
Right.
But there's always someone in your environment who you can connect with, who resonates with what you've gone through. And that's what the chef does. I think in another sense, the story is really a story about how to mentor. Because if you look at the way the chef treats the boy, this is a fragile little kid. And it would be really easy to fail, you know, in your effort to try to reach him. So how does the chef deal with him? How does he talk to him? How does he handle him? How does he rebuke him? How does he correct him? How does he instruct him? For me, writing the book was really fascinating, because you know you often don't know how these things are going to go until you watch them emerge in the page. And I didn't know what the chef was going to do, but watching him and how he treats the boy over the weeks and months of the book was just fascinating for me. And I when I grow up, I hope I'm like the chef.
Well, you know what, also, too, the idea of mentoring that you speak, mentoring is really raising children. Mentoring is really having employees. Mentoring is really being a friend to a friend. Mentoring is also being a spouse to another. You know, it's all about relationships.
Yes.
And it,
yes.
If you can just look at it as so simply as when in the book The Recipe, again, you know, the character I really find as the chef is that he really does not guide in mentoring as his path. He's sort of like seeding the path, but he allows he allows, you know, Owen to be able to decide, is that the path I'll go on? In other words, you don't always give the people the words. You don't always give them the answers. You're just kind of like, is there a potential for this and how you put it out there, you know? I think to not create the situation and hope that he will fall into it. You're almost allowing him to create his own situation and guiding him through it.
That's what any great teacher does. I mean, from Socrates on, right? And you said that beautifully. He's like seeding the path. He's not pushing him onto a path. And there is a moment in the book where Owen is faced with a choice, and you know the chef inside desperately wants him to make choice A, and he makes choice B, and the chef could stop him,
right?
But he doesn't. And then the boy changes his mind, comes back in the room, and you know, and he eventually takes the path that you're hoping he will. But the chef doesn't even try to influence him, and that to me was almost excruciating to watch, but incredibly noble of him. You know, it's funny. There's a moment like that now that I think about it in The Go-Giver. The Go-Giver is based on five principles, and we call them. This is The Go-Giver is the one that I wrote with Bob Berg a decade ago. Okay. I was talking about earlier. And in The Go-Giver, it's based on five principles, which we call the five laws of stratospheric success. And the first four laws are in a sense, all about giving, different aspects of giving, giving value to others, putting other people's interests first, taking an interest in others, authenticity, which is giving your true self, not being afraid to show yourself. And so all that giving. And then there's this, in each one of those lessons, the hero of the story, a guy named Joe, learns from a different mentor. And then comes Friday, the last day of the book, and he's in this meeting with the mentor of the book, which is a man named Pindar. And Pindar just kind of lets him run. And he eventually comes up with the fifth law himself, kind of blurts it out in probably his most articulate and poetic page of the book. He sort of blossoms in front of your eyes and comes out with this fifth law. And it's interesting because as the book started getting out there, and Bob and I started doing interviews and talking with people, and now over the years, we hear this over and over. People say, you know, the first four laws, I'm totally in sync with those. Like, that's how I've always tried to live my life. I really, really resonate. But that fifth law, oof, I have a hard time with that one. The fifth law is the law of receptivity, which says that the only way that you can keep on giving is to stay open to receiving. And the fifth law is about the fact that you can't be a giving person without also being a receiving person. Mm-hmm. That you can't just be self-sacrificing and give and say no, please, and refuse to take payment, and that it's not, you know, necessarily noble to give away your products for free. Mm-hmm. It's about the idea that giving and receiving are part of the same cycle. And it's remarkable to me how many people have come back and say, you know, I've really got to learn that fifth law because I think I'm a giving person, but I have a hard time being on the receiving end. It's like I have a hard time accepting a compliment. I have a hard time asking for payment. I have a hard time, you know, it's like I'm happy to do a favor, but I'm reluctant to ask for a favor. Well, my experience is the genuinely successful people in the world, I don't just mean financially successful, but successful in terms of living big, rich lives, fulfilling, satisfied lives, love to give and love to receive, right? And that whole law, that came out of Joe's mouth. It didn't come out of any of the teachers' mouths. And the beauty of that is the behind the scenes of that is Bob and I didn't plan that when we were writing the book. We didn't have that sketched out. We didn't have any idea what the fifth law would be. It just kind of came out of the page. So, yeah, I think the maybe the secret, if there is a secret to being a great mentor, is loving and believing in the person. And as you say, throwing seeds in the path, but letting them find their own way.
But also, too, and I see it taking it a step further, is that the receptivity part, really the story you call the recipe, the book, we really focus on Owen, you know, on his path and his story. But really, the dark horse, as they may say, or as I always call it, the rose in the woods, is really the chef, because what did he receive? You know, he received a full life. He gave back to his friend's son, you know. He gave back the love that a father might have had. So he kind of learned that characteristic of being a father, of having a son, of being able to mentor and to go to that deep part of his heart probably that may not have been touched prior to that. So he really learned how to expand his heart so financially. I mean, probably, hey, that's going to be your next book, you know. How can you take that corner of your heart that, you know, was seated, that you gave out, and what did you do with it? You know, what did you do with that now, and how did you grow? And so I really think the dark horse, again, in the book, the recipe is the chef, because I think it's just such a story of no judgment. Mm-hmm. It's a story of there's no predisposition to anything. You're not looking to get anything back. You're not looking and saying, you know, if he makes a mistake, well, I'm not going to take you back, that kind of thing, you know. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like, okay, so he learned. He expanded. And, you know, and so did I learn. I learned that I can have no judgment. I learned that my heart can grow even bigger because maybe I've been there. All of these things, so I really think that it's really about expanding that darkness and inside sometimes and saying, you know, I didn't know there was another corner to my heart. And I think that's where both of your books are in, almost in step form. You know, The Go-Giver was first, and then The Recipe was next, and now we're going to go into The Darkness for the next one and see just how big can your heart be. And I think that's where a lot of people are in this year, you know, 2018. It's really is that people are really saying, there's something right in that core that I want to touch, that I want to feel, that I want to know, and how big is that? And I think that's where millennials are kind of like encouraging us to do that, because they're saying there's so many potentials. You know, I even spoke with I'm working with several end-of-life clients right now, and one woman, she has two in her family, and they're pretty imminent within potentially the next 2 weeks to 3 months. But the point is that I said to her, I said, I want you to drive butterflies. I want you to write a butterfly in your hand. I want you to put a butterfly sticker on your head. I want you to do everything you think butterflies. Dream butterflies. She said, why? I said, because you need to release them. If it's their choice to go and it's their time to go, let them release. Let them go. And that's about getting back to that core. We always think about everybody else's story, how we fit into it. But then we also need to think about our part and what does it give back to us. So she came back and she said, yeah, you know, oh, my gosh, I just can't get butterflies off my mind, you know, kind of idea. Because she released that, you know, and I think Chef in the book, you know, he did the same thing. You know, he kind of, as he brought, you know, Owen into it, he released his sorrow or sadness that his friend was gone, or he lost his feeling that maybe he could have done more, or he grew something inside himself, and the idea of growing again, the rose in the woods, you know. So maybe that's your book.
Dr. Jeanette, I got to tell you, I love what you said about the chef. That's so great, because that's a beautiful observation, and not many people have made that. And I really love that, because it's you're absolutely right. It's yes, we've got a student and a teacher here, but it isn't just the student who grows. I mean, the chef changes. He gains something. He learns. Right. He even learns from the boy something at some point. So that's lovely. I appreciate that. Thank you for that. And it's, I also love your image of the rose in the woods. I think it goes beautifully with the rose on the cover of the book.
Oh, yes, it does, doesn't it? Yeah, and I think all the time, sometimes we always like are looking at, you know, when someone dies or we have a loss or something or we lose something, we always think it's the end. And it's like I had said to someone, I think I said it to this client the other day, I said, so really, I understand we're looking at a loss, but it is it a loss? Is it a loss of the human body, and then we're free to be able to go on as a spirit? And is that really limiting? Can we say, you know what? Goodness, it's sort of like, can I change my wardrobe and throw all my clothes out? You know what I mean?
Right.
Kind of idea. And be another person. Am I willing to shed this body that seems so difficult to carry right now? And can I go on and say I'm a free spirit? And can the people behind that I leave behind also release that? And, you know, really you see that in the book, because when Owen went out and he started to do his own work and become his own self, it may seem like those other people got left behind, but they really didn't, because they kind of came along the journey with him.
Absolutely.
Because you bring it back to the end of the book, didn't he come back?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So really it's about how you can bring your life full circle, but not always be tethered to these old dogmas of, oh, my gosh, something died. Oh, my gosh, I lost something. No, you didn't. You gained so much more. Turn it the other way. Flip it the other way. Let's start flipping forward, you know, instead of holding on. Yes?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's you know, there's a point in the book, and I should let listeners know that there is a lot of food in the book. There's a lot of cooking. A lot of the book takes place in the kitchen, so there are going to be vegetables are going to be sliced and cooked, and many things are going to be eaten in the course of reading this book. There's one scene where the chef is teaching the boy about mirepoix, and these little diced vegetables, and, you know, traditionally onions, carrots, and celery, but there are other combinations in other cultures. And that formed the base for thousands of dishes, you know, that formed the base for soup stocks and stews and roasts and all kinds of things. And so he's describing to Owen how you take these vegetables, dice them up, maybe you peel them, maybe you don't, dice them large, dice them small, depends on the dish, and you get them in the pan, you're sautéing them or you're sweating them, however you're cooking them, and then you start adding other ingredients, maybe you make the stock or whatever, and then you strain the vegetables out and you toss them. Mm-hmm. And Owen can just not wrap his mind around this. What, you throw them out? He said, "Well, yeah, they've contributed their flavor,
right.
their energy." And he's like, mm-hmm. but you throw them out." Mm-hmm. And so the chef says, "Look, who was your favorite teacher?" And Owen immediately remembers this teacher he had in the second grade, and her voice and how she used to tell stories and how he feels, you know, enveloped and surrounded by this velvety storyteller's voice. The memory comes to mind immediately. And so the chef goes, "Like, how many years has it been since you've seen her?" And it's been ages. To Owen, 7 years is like you know, three lifetimes.
Right.
So
right.
It's been a long time. Half his life he hasn't seen her. And the chef says, "Yeah, but she's not gone. She's here because she imparted her flavors, her essence, her energies." And so, you know, it's kind of a cliche that we have when someone dies, we say, "Yes, but you carry them with you in your heart."
Mm-hmm.
But it's the absolute truth. They're not gone. Those flavors are still in the soup, still in the roast. They've imparted their flavors. And that's, the chef doesn't come out and say it,
mm-hmm.
but what he's also saying is, that's your father.
Right.
You know, your father was, you were cooked with your father, and now you are part of him, and he's part of you. And so it's just as you say, discard the body. You know, my wife's mom died a few years ago, and we were at her memorial service, and it was my turn to talk, and I described a scene where there are, oh gosh, I wish I could remember how exactly I said it, but basically, to make it short, imagine conceived before birth, you're in the womb, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's like, maybe you're quintuplets. So you and your four siblings are all huddled around in this dark, warm, cozy, wet place. And week after week, month after month, food supply is free, room and board is free. You're having a blast, right? You're growing, you're experiencing things, you're all nestled, the five of you together. And then all of a sudden, there's this kind of cataclysm, and one of the five just vanishes.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going like, "Oh my God, what happened here?"
Mm-hmm.
She was so young. I can't believe it. I wasn't ready for this. She's been
right.
taken from us. And all four of you were sitting around grieving. Of course, on the other side, the nurses and the family members are all slapping the baby and saying, "Yay, she's here," and seeing this
right.
bright, beautiful baby in the air. But from the perspective of the inside, it looks like she's died and she's gone, I don't know, to heaven or to some other world,
right.
or maybe she's just disappeared and doesn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, that's kind of how it is for us. When someone departs, we think, "Oh my gosh, they're gone." Well, no, not really. They've just had their visa stamped and they've moved
mm-hmm.
on to another port of call. You know?
Right. Right. And I think the idea of attachment came along with history. You know, after the war, they felt poor, you know, after the Depression, so they had to have things, you know. I have to have
mm-hmm.
a house, have cars, have this, have that. And now we're at the point of, I hope, understanding or coming to the conceptual idea that our life is an experience and everything in it is just an experience and we don't attach to it. We see this
yeah.
now where a lot of people are saying, "I'm downsizing, I'm letting go, things are
mm-hmm.
not that important." And we hope that, you know, you'll be able to go forth. I mean, I live in New Orleans. I stayed for Hurricane Katrina, and the idea of, you know, my husband at that
yeah.
time, you know, he came out of his house to come get me at the hospital because that's where I was because we stayed for it. And
yes.
He came out with a shopping bag with two pairs of pants and a pair of socks, and that's all he had left. His house and everything else went, you know.
Oh, my
so
God.
He lost
yes.
everything. And, I mean, people
yeah.
don't understand the concept of what does everything mean.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
and even I myself, you know, this past several weeks and months have been I just shut everything off. I mean, literally I pulled the plug, sent cable back,
mm-hmm.
said I'm done for 7 days and what that experience would mean. And it was really, are we interconnected in a world or are we disconnected in the world? And I think your book, The Recipe, brings us back to connecting to ourselves versus connecting to those outside things that are supposed to fix us, keep us in touch. Social media is not who we are. You know, television and, oh my gosh, reacting to events is not who we are. It's our value inside, going back to your first book, The Go-Giver. What is the value of your heart and your inside versus what is always how you dance and play on the outside, you know?
Yeah.
And I think you know, like you say about what you said before about markers in history and how the world changed, I think when Katrina came along, people had the, oh, poor them kind of attitude, and they didn't realize that it could have been, oh, poor me too, you know? And I think that's when all of these other big hits started coming along, earthquakes, you know, natural disasters and all these other things started to show up. And then people realized, hey, that might be me one day. Maybe I need to be a little different, you know. Maybe I need to change how I am, you know. Don't you think?
Yeah, you know, I do. And it all goes back to, you know, what is the impact of loss and what's the value of loss. Mm-hmm. Now, my father grew up in mid-war, between the wars, interbellum, Germany. After he was born right after the end of World War One, and so he was in his teens as Hitler was rising to power, and Hitler came to his high school one day and gave a talk in the gymnasium there and or in the auditorium, and my dad says he vividly remembers the talk and just how terrifying it was. He was forced to leave. He had one Jewish parent, one so-called pure German parent. His mom was Jewish, so he was under you know, risky circumstance. So at the age of 19, he emigrated to Italy, and then after a year, things started getting dicey in Italy.
Right.
So he had to then emigrate to England. At which point, he eventually got out of England and came to the U.S. And naturalized and was promptly inducted into the U.S. Army and sent to Germany. He loved his home. He loved his heritage. He went to school in a school that was founded by Martin Luther. I mean, he was steeped in centuries of culture that was, you know, part and parcel of who he was. He was a classical musician, a choral conductor and musicologist, and a great one. And so when he came to this country, he lost everything. He lost his culture. Right. He lost. And it was interesting. Growing up with him, he had a number of friends, colleagues in the music world who were from Germany who come over during the war. And I noticed there seemed to be two different kinds of expats in my father's life. There were some people who spoke only German at home. They brought their kids up speaking German. And they would always speak German with my dad. And then there was my dad and people like him who basically completely Americanized. I mean, he never really did. He was always an odd duck in this culture, an old world gentleman in the new world. But he embraced his new world fully. And it was interesting because he really had nothing. And it was my earliest experience, sort of my pre-life experience of losing everything. Now, I've gone through bankruptcy. I've lost businesses. I've lost a child. I've lost two marriages. I've lost millions of dollars. I've written books that I thought were going to be international bestsellers that just sank like a stone for one reason or another. I've been through lots of different kinds of losses, although they pale in comparison to the kinds of loss I see other people going through, losing limbs, or losing, you know, physical capacities, senses, losing their eyes, their ears, whatever. And I'll tell you what, Dr. Jeanette, I 6 years ago, my wife, not 6 years, more, almost a decade ago, my wife broke her knee in about two dozen places. She just fractured the patella in a really, really horrible compound fracture. And she was, in a wheelchair for quite a while, then on crutches, and she did have surgery. She had a scope and then another scope, and they said she'd never walk again, and she did. She got back up, and a few years later, she broke the left knee again. And we figured that was, you know, we didn't figure, but we were told, you know, that's it.
Right.
You might get, well, you know what? We walk 4 miles a day. Mm-hmm. She's completely recovered that knee. But I'll tell you this, there is not a day that goes by that not only her, but me too, that we both, like right now, I'm actually standing in my office at home and I'm walking through my office and I'm standing, sitting here marveling at this thing that we do with walking where you fall in one direction and then fall in the other and your foot keeps you from falling all the way down. And it's just, I marvel at the fact that I have legs and I can walk. It really, loss really does teach you, or it really can teach you, to take nothing for granted and to have profound gratitude for the simplest of things. And that's something that the chef teaches the boy. He starts there, tasting the simplest of things, appreciating the simplest of things. He sits the boy down. The very first test the boy goes through about cooking is to sit down and eat a hot dog and a Coke. And the boy is like, oh, you've got to be kidding me. A hot dog and a Coke, that's a big culinary test. But the chef says, I could sit you down in front of a $300 meal and put myself in front of a paper plate and a hot dog. Which one of us would have the better meal?
I would,
because I've learned how to taste and put aside my expectations and my issues and my grievances and my baggage and all that, and just be in the moment and genuinely taste what I'm tasting. And that is, I think, one of the core lessons of the book.
Yeah, you know, John, in closing, I think I'll share this story. You know, I can remember when my kids were growing up, and I had four kids and two ex-husbands, and I was, you know, in college working a full-time job and just trying to do it myself. And I remember, I mean, I could make wonders with a box of Mrs. Grass's soup, you know. It was, you know,
yes.
I mean, because that's, you know, what we had, you know, and we really didn't have much. And I can remember one day when my daughter was older, she says, I never realized we were poor. And I went, wow.
Great.
Because
that's
the point
great.
Was, yeah, because the point
Good
was
for you.
That you just, I mean, I can remember at Christmas time, you know, getting a cake mix for a dollar, and then they had these little cream de mince candies at Christmas. They were a dollar. So I would, you know, cut them in pieces and stick them on the cake, and it was like this marvelous cake. Nobody ate it, but they thought it was the greatest thing, you know, because it was something, in other words, how do you make your life special, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's really what it's all about is, what can you bring forth for each day? You know, sometimes I see people with a health crisis, and they're like, okay, well, this is the way we're going to do it. We're commanding that it happen this way, and what are all the parameters? And they listen to the doctor, and blah, blah, blah. And they kind of go down this, against, as I said in the beginning of the show, this silo existence. And then it happens again, just like you said with your wife. And it happens again because there was something that you missed there. It wasn't about directing and controlling the situation. It was about experiencing the situation. Two totally different viable options that we have and potentials in this world is, do I want to control my path of my life, or do I wish to experience it? And that's really, I think, in closing, I think that's what both of your books are about, don't you think?
I will definitely take that. Yes, thank you. Sure. I'll say amen to that one.
Yeah. Well, John, can you share a little bit with the listeners about how to find out more information about your work and your books? That would be terrific.
Sure. It's very easy. The books are all on Amazon and everywhere else that books are sold. But also, I got everything on my website. And my website is simply my name, JohnDavidMann, with two N's. .com, JohnDavidMann.com. All my books are there. You can see sample chapters. You can download a chapter, read kind of the background of the book. My blog is there, which is where I have conversations with myself in front of people.
Yeah.
It's all there, JohnDavidMann.com.
Well, John, it was such a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I am so glad that we persevered through technical difficulties that made this happen.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. If you'd like to find out more information about John David Mann, his books are The Go-Giver, A Little Story About a Powerful Business Idea, The Recipe, A Story of Loss, Love, and the Ingredients of Greatness. Please do check out his website. The link is on the bottom of today's show page. And I would definitely say both of these books are well verse to be able to be given as a gift. The Recipe, I would give this to any teen. And let me tell you, it almost should be like an eighth grade reading group, you know, that this book should be great. But it should also be read with parents, Because parents, we've got this dogma and this judgment book in our head. Our kids are going to do this. They're going to go that way. And I'm going to make sure that they la, la, la. What you're really trying to say is that you want them to be a reflection of you. Can you just let your children go on and be the potential they are meant to be? What do you think? So please do check out the link for John Mann on the bottom of today's show page. And again, this is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and have a wonderful day.
Today we discussed many life-changing concepts. Who do you turn to, and how do you know what is best when faced with a health crisis? Dr. Jeanette is a patient advocate. She listens to the patient, the doctors, and the family, clarifies the health issues and concerns, then helps the patient make the best choices going forward. If you would like help implementing change into your life and health, we can talk and see where you are stuck and how to improve the quality of your life. Check the link on the bottom of today's show page or visit drjeanettegallagher.com to schedule a phone appointment today.